This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
You're listening to The West Wing Weekly. I'm Hrishikesh Hirway.
And I'm Joshua Molina.
And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 14. It's called Take This Sabbath Day.
It first aired on February 9th, 2000. The teleplay is by Aaron Sorkin. The story is by Lawrence O'Donnell Jr. and Paul Redford and Aaron Sorkin. You know, there's ampersand and then there's the word and. So it's Lawrence O'Donnell Jr. ampersand Paul Redford, meaning they were working as a team.
I'm pretty sure that all has to do with union rules.
Now, from the Writers Guild, the ampersand means that the two writers are a team and are treated as one person for WGA purposes. The other version, with the word and spelled out, indicates that the writers worked at different times. In this case, they're considered separate entities.
Here's the NBC synopsis.
Here we go.
After the Supreme Court refuses to stay the execution of a federal prisoner convicted of killing two drug kingpins, President Bartlett must decide whether or not to commute his sentence in less than 48 hours, so he calls upon his sagacious childhood priest for guidance. Meanwhile, even Toby feels the heat over the controversial issue when he hears a sermon on capital punishment from his rabbi. Elsewhere, a hearing-challenged combative campaign manager demands an audience with the president when her Democratic congressional candidate has been purposefully underfunded by his party before the upcoming election to unseat an incumbent.
It's funny, I don't remember any of the plot lines mentioned. The only thing that stuck with me was the ampersand and the word and. So, general reaction?
This is, I think, maybe one of the greatest pieces of television ever made.
I can't even follow that. That made me break out in a sweat.
What do you think?
I liked it too.
Yeah.
No, I think it's terrific. I do. I don't know if I'm willing to. I've got to go deep within and think. I need a year of review before I can sign off on that exact statement. But I think it's a pretty great episode of the show, and it's a great standalone episode. Maybe we should start easy and then build to deeper conversation.
Let's try and take this one chronologically.
Ha! That'll last.
Let's see how it goes.
Yeah. Why not?
We start in the Supreme Court. There are 8 justices sitting because Mendoza hasn't been confirmed. And we find out there's a death row inmate who's been applied for a stay of execution, and they deny the stay of execution. And then we go to the 3 public defenders who were in charge of this case.
Most notably, public defender Bobby Zane, played by one of my oldest and dearest friends, Noah Emmerich.
You guys live together, right?
That is true.
When did you guys live together?
I'd rather not get into our romantic history. No, we lived, we lived together at Yale as we lived off campus together. He's a year older than I, was a year ahead of me, but we shared a house for a year. We both moved to New York City, and then we both eventually moved to Los Angeles in 1992. We got a house together in LA and lived together for several years.
And he was also in A Few Good Men, I think.
He was in the national tour of A Few Good Men.
Did he get that gig because of you?
Well, I guess he got to know Aaron through me, and he got the gig because of Aaron. And so by the transitive law, you are correct, he got the gig through me.
And so continuing the transitive property, he also probably got this episode through you.
Sure. I would say his entire career he owes to me.
Well, thank you. As a big fan of Stan Beeman on The Americans, I say thank you.
Let me just say, in a real sense, I think, I know that he went into acting. If you go way, way, way back, I think due to at my behest, we did a commencement show, show just after graduation, after my sophomore year and his junior, we did a production of Anything Goes. I played Moonface Martin. It was musically directed by my cousin Stuart Molina, who's now the conductor of the Harrisburg Symphony Orchestra. And I urged Noah to audition. He had a little interest in acting, but he was not a... I probably have deprived the world of what would have been a first-rate constitutional scholar because I veered him off his path and study of history and the U.S. Constitution by pushing him to play a small role in an amateur production of Anything Goes, got him obsessed with acting. My memory, too, is he had about three lines and he blew one of them consistently where he would say, as the captain of the ship in Anything Goes, he had to say, there was some sort of problem. And he would say, the something is you, purser. And I remember him saying at least one night, one performance, the problem is you, skipper. And then there was a long pause as he pondered the fact that he was the skipper and that what he was saying made no sense. And yet somewhere from that moment, there is a line to be drawn to his now incredible work as Stan Beeman on The Americans and his pretty impressive body of work that he's done in film and TV and theater since that moment.
He was going to be a great lawyer, but much more importantly, now he plays a lawyer.
Yeah, he plays a not great lawyer.
Yeah.
Although he's a lawyer who cares. I actually really enjoyed Noah in this. It's a small appearance, but he's very good. One, he has almost a throwaway line, but that informs the rest of it, where he says he can get, he thinks, Sam Seaborn on the phone because he used to beat him up as a kid, or he used to bully him.
He used to beat him up in high school.
I used to beat him up in high school, exactly. And you can kind of see in Noah's... First of all, he looks like somebody who might have beaten someone else up in high school and a bit of a bully. And then when he talks to Sam, he really does bully him.
You are going to go to the president. You're going to tell him he can't run from this one. He's got to consider my client. You're going to tell him that.
I don't talk to the president that way, Bobby. Nobody talks to the president that way. And I got to tell you, not that many people talk to me that way anymore.
And actually gets Sam to reveal what synagogue Toby goes to, much to Toby's dismay. And... So he's not the worst public defender. He cares.
In a lot of ways, it seems like they've set him up to be this jerk. He was a bully. He got fired from his fancy law firm job. And yet his passion here to save this guy's life spurs the entire episode.
Yeah, that's right. And Aaron wrote the whole opening kind of beautifully because life and death hangs in the balance. And... what happens is very human. This guy says, yeah, I used to beat him up. I think I can get him on the phone. We eventually see that Sam Seaborn's out the door, literally out the door, to go on a sailing trip and to get some much needed vacation hours away from the endless grind of working in the White House. And he leaves from outside the door back into his office because that phone is ringing and that little red light is lighting up and he takes the call. And regardless of how everything ends up, it's just Aaron's little balancing act of the macro huge stakes goings on and the tiny little sort of quotidian moments of your day. Are you going to leave for vacation? Are you going to come back and answer the phone? Kind of weaves them together beautifully.
I promise I'm not trying to jump ahead too much, but...
You may if you like.
The other thing that's really nice about that moment that you were talking about where Sam comes back into the office because his phone is ringing instead of going on vacation is his willingness to take the call, literally and sort of metaphorically, versus later on we find out that this issue is such a tough one to grapple with that Leo... considers that if he had known it was going to happen, he would have kept the president out of the country so that he wouldn't have to take the call.
We were totally unprepared for this. We were caught in the headlights. This thing was supposed to go back to the Sixth Circuit, and I don't know how.
What are you talking about prepared? The court sat. What would you have done different? What would you have done different? You kept the president out of the country another 2 days?
Yes.
But in this instance, Sam has every right to just walk out the door. He's on vacation. He's done it. But there's a sense of like civic duty or whatever loyalty to his job that he's like, no, I'm going to come back in. I am going to answer the phone. And that, of course, changes everything.
Yeah. This is a further revelation of his commitment that we've seen in the writing the birthday memo. If you know, he's willing to miss a date for that. He's certainly going to skip sailing to deal with this.
Right. So we have the setup of the death penalty, but then almost immediately after the introduction of that plot line, we get the second story, the B plot, with Josh, and he has a bachelor party to go to.
Yes.
The death penalty stuff is handled with so much gravity, but the episode is also so funny.
It is really funny, yeah. And it doesn't feel like it's two episodes working against each other.
Yeah. I think in some ways you maybe laugh harder because there's some sense of relief that those scenes give you. It works in the episode's favor to have the two different modes that it's working between.
Yeah, I agree with you. We get the piece of information about the bachelor party during this great multi-directional walk and talk. It's kind of about a back and forth. I was watching that again, and the camera work on that walk and talk is amazing. I mean, the camera person just really has got to be super aware of his surroundings and framing every moment. And it's incredible choreography. It changes direction multiple times. Now that Tommy has sort of established this style, it's easy to take for granted these difficult technical pieces of acting and filming that are being done. I mean, the lighting, the camera work, the actors, the performance, everything has to work in one go. This is just a particularly intricate and beautifully played walk and talk.
You have to be here at 10 tomorrow morning.
We have to be here at 10 tomorrow morning.
Why me?
Because you work for me.
I have things to do tomorrow, Josh. It was my Saturday, too.
What things?
I have to go shopping.
For what?
Whatever. It's Saturday.
10 minutes. When it's over, I'll buy you some shoes.
Really?
What do you think about Josh planning on buying Donna some shoes?
Yeah, now, I mean, especially because we've discussed it, I guess I'm always looking for it. They're just, do it already. I mean, it really is, actually. It's just kind of like, yeah, do you guys not realize that you're dating?
It feels like, I mean, the idea that a man would buy a woman shoes, it sort of reminds me of Pulp Fiction when they talk about giving a woman a foot massage. That's a level of intimacy that goes to another level.
Yeah, that's the word I was about to say. That's an intimate thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not normal for a boss to be saying.
Or any man to any woman who is not his significant other. It once again shows that not only do the senior staff have very little control over their own schedule, there's these waves of personnel repercussions that go along with it. So suddenly Josh has this assignment, and now Donna has to be in the office all day on a Saturday as well.
Yes, that's right. There's a domino effect.
A domino?
Nice.
Were you at all tuned into the death penalty debate in the 90s?
I was tuned in the 70s when at my yeshiva, I was assigned, we had a death penalty debate. And I remember, I can't remember whether I was assigned or I'm guessing I volunteered for the anti-death penalty side. And I remember very ardently arguing my case while my sixth grade teacher, Mrs. Alter, played Mattel electronic football. She was literally, I'm not kidding, doing that thing with, I think, the phys ed teacher who was in the room. Oh. And then I remember she, I think, had some criticisms for my either debate technique or content. And I remember saying, if you hadn't been playing Mattel electronic football while I spoke, I might take your criticism more seriously. Because I was that kind of sixth grader.
You're that kind of 50-year-old as well.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I certainly haven't mellowed. Well, should we get personal? Should we get into our own takes on the death penalty before we dive into this entire episode?
Sure. You first. Where
are you? To me, it is a thorny and complicated and not black and white issue. Although I have a black and white stance on it, I am completely against capital punishment. And for me, there's just one very little easy escape valve that makes the argument simple when in reality it isn't. And that's just that people get exonerated.
Yes.
You know, there's DNA evidence, there's new scientific techniques. And, you know, I think I read somewhere 140 people or over 140 people since 1976 have been exonerated from death row.
Yes.
So to me, if there's any chance that somebody is innocent, you can't have the ultimate penalty. And now this makes it easier for me to not have to argue what are areas of it that make me feel more ambivalent. And it was interesting when Mandy and CJ are basically saying, I feel nothing.
He killed two people, probably more. I'm sorry I don't get worked up over it.
Me neither. That's what I'm saying. Me neither.
And I often do feel that way when I see on the news or read on the internet or that an execution is happening. Often I see the details of what the person has been found guilty of. And sometimes I do feel, wow, I feel nothing. So I have that overall objection to it, and it's absolute. But then when it is enforced in a situation where it seems clear to me the guy did, or it's generally a guy, something horrific, I don't feel terrible emotionally.
I actually credit this episode, besides being a great piece of entertainment, for fundamentally informing my views on the death penalty. I was ambivalent about it, and I could see arguments for it. I certainly had sympathy for people, families of victims who would want to see a perpetrator be executed. But I think after watching this episode, when I first saw it, and certainly subsequent times after that, it's reinforced for me the idea that, no, it's wrong. And then reading more, learning about things like the Innocence Project and examples of times when people have been wrongfully imprisoned, the inherent racism that exists in the criminal justice system in the U.S. There's just so many.
That's also, I agree, I didn't mention, but a huge element, the fact that for this ultimate penalty, the, I think, fairly clear sense that it's not fairly enforced.
Right.
Is yet another element. But here, what's interesting too, though, is this absolute of, well, what if somebody innocent is put to death? I don't think is ever mentioned in this episode, which is not to fault the episode. In a sense, Aaron really focuses more on the morality of taking a human life.
Right, and less about the flaws.
I'm not sure that there's a mention of racial inequity and how how capital punishment is handed down as a sentence either.
There is one.
I want you to know that I had a number of people on my staff search for a reason the public would find palatable to commute the sentence. Technicality. Any evidence of racism?
Ah, you're right. You're absolutely right.
But yeah, you're right. They really are talking about the merits of the death penalty with the assumption that the system works, and without the caveat that there are fundamental institutional problems with law enforcement and how prosecution and punishment works in this country.
Right. So in a sense, I feel like what Aaron does is to dig into the harder stuff. In other words, he focuses it more on
the morals and not the
process. Sort of that the gooey part that is a little bit harder for most of us to really get to or to access, and is harder to discuss and frame. It's interesting to me that that's how he decides to frame this discussion, and through a multi-religious lens.
Yeah, no, that's a great point. That the moral argument for the death penalty is much more complicated than one based on the facts of judicial process.
But the real focus is on, is vengeance even something we as a society should be in the business of? And is taking a life something that's ever okay?
Okay, we jumped way ahead.
I knew we would. I wrote down here, fjords and lederhosen.
Yes, yes.
If you'll look out the left side of the cabin, you'll see the fjords. Then we got a history of the fjords. Then we got a quiz on the fjords. Do you have any idea how much I would like to dress you up in lederhosen and drop kick you into a fjord?
You don't
right
know
now
how to have fun when we're traveling.
It was quite a trip.
So here are my two questions. Are there fjords in Sweden, and don't they wear lederhosen in Germany? I don't know. I'm confused.
There are fjords in Sweden.
Okay.
I thought lederhosen was German, but where's Heidi from? Switzerland.
Switzerland, Germany, Austria, all lederhosen. Sweden, I think not so much.
No, it's true.
I'm just taking a shot at CJ.
So much for Sam's claim to Bobby Zane that nobody talks to the president that way. There's a great moment when they come back to Josh after the bachelor party on Saturday morning, and he's in his office and he's looking at Donna when he's drunk in their first exchange. At one point when he's looking at her and he's like baffled, there's a face that he makes where his lower lip is just up.
He does a very good hungover. I love when he says, I have a very delicate system.
No, she says it's even better than that. She says,
"You have a very sensitive system.
I wish you'd stop telling people that. It makes me sound like an idiot."
But then he calls it back later. It's true.
Yes,
that's funny.
When he finally gets confronted by Joey Lucas,
"Are you drunk?
I have a very delicate system."
That's right. That made me laugh. That made me laugh and made me angry because my wife, the lovely Melissa, does like occasionally to say to me, "You're a delicate darling." Just not my favorite thing to be called.
I don't mind it. I am a delicate flower.
Yeah, I guess I am too.
Here's another great funny moment. When we're in the temple and the rabbi is speaking and Toby gets up to go take the call, he exchanges a look with the rabbi of like, yeah, it's me getting up in the middle of his phone goes off, you know, it's all bad. But then the button on that scene is so good. Toby leans on the chairs and they all go clattering. But the thing that's amazing that I never noticed until this watch is that the rabbi says the word quietly. He's in the middle of a sentence and he says quietly. And then, and then Toby knocks over all the chairs.
All right, I'm on my way.
Quietly.
It's very funny. The rabbi, of course, played by David Proval. He was in Mean Streets, Scorsese movie, way back when, and was Richie Aprile in The Sopranos. I don't know if you know. Were you a Sopranos fan?
I never watched The Sopranos.
Oh dear Lord.
It's not to say I never watched it. I watched the first season. Here's what I'm going to say about The Sopranos. When it was on, I was sort of like, there have been so many great mobster stories told.
Sure.
And this one, it felt like the only new thing that it was introducing, the new element, was the psychiatrist part of it. And I found those conversations so annoying.
They were not my favorite part of The Sopranos.
And the whole thing about like dream sequences, I hate dream sequences so much. And then I think everybody was so in love with The Sopranos that it made my slight annoyance so much deeper that I was like, you know what? I'm out.
Yeah, I completely understand that. But you should watch The Sopranos because it was really good. If only to see David Proval, who plays this wise, loving rabbi in this episode of The West Wing.
I might even say he was a little bit sagacious.
I would say that as well. He plays an incredibly ruthless character very, very convincingly in The Sopranos. Yeah,
I mean,
he's really, really good. You want to just see, you want to juxtapose two extremes for an actor. Look at those two performances. I love the level of detail that Aaron puts into a script. So Bobby Zane, as played by young Noah Emmerich, has convinced the sagacious rabbi, as played by David Proval, to fashion a sermon, really to reach out to Toby Ziegler, one of his congregants, and apparently a regular temple goer. Toby gets his phone call and walks out, and as he's walking out, the sermon kind of drifts off, but I can hear where he was headed, and it's actually a great little piece. The theme of the rabbi's sermon being that vengeance isn't Jewish, and right. I guess it's springtime. It's about to be, Passover is coming soon, or Pesach for our Jewish listeners. And the rabbi, as Toby's headed out of the synagogue, is about to talk about something that's done on the Seder nights, the two Seders for Passover. Mm-hmm.
This is about the Haggadah?
This is about the Haggadah, very good. And in the Haggadah, there's a portion where we read aloud the 10 plagues that God supposedly smote the Egyptians with. And as each plague is read, there's a ritual or a tradition of dipping your finger into your wine glass and taking out a drop of wine for each plague as a way of acknowledging that even as Jews around the world are celebrating their freedom at a Seder, they are not rejoicing in the misery even of their tormentors.
Interesting.
Yeah, we take one drop out of our glass, so our glass is less full, wine being associated with celebration. So that's where he was just starting to head. There's just a few words, but I love that the sermon within the episode, which is not largely heard, had a real direction.
To be reminded by the Haggadah, the simple truth, that violence begets violence. Vengeance is not Jewish.
will pour 10 drops.
The vengeance is not Jewish is such a beautiful, complex line.
Absolutely. And I think you could have a, it's not something necessarily to be taken at face value.
Sure.
For a people whose holy book includes eye for an eye. It right. is sort of expanded on later when it's suggested that vengeance is God's province.
Right. Karl Malden says,
"Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord." You know what that means? God is the only one who gets to kill people.
In a sense, I feel like that's part of the argument of the vengeance isn't Jewish, because I can imagine people say, well, what do you mean? Eye for an eye. It's from the, it's in the Torah. And it's also made explicit elsewhere in the episode by the rabbi, all the things that in the Old Testament or the Jewish Bible that were punishable by death.
It says a rebellious child can be brought to the city gates and stoned to death. It says homosexuality is an abomination and punishable by death. It says men can be polygamous and slavery is acceptable.
This is something I wanted to get into with you a little bit, and maybe we are not qualified to discuss this, but...
What are we ultimately really qualified to discuss, Rishi?
Yeah, that's true.
And let's not let our lack of depth of knowledge stop us from discussing anything.
We started talking about this a little while back with Ed and Larry, with Peter James Smith and William Duffy, when we were talking about interpretation of the text and backstory. And we were talking about it in terms of the Constitution. We were talking about it specifically in terms of like stories and screenplay. And you invoked the Talmud as something that doesn't have backstory. But then there's this other part to it, this new wrinkle that I think gets added in here, when the rabbi says,
"For all I know, that thinking reflected the best wisdom of its time. But it's just plain wrong by any modern standard."
And the idea of the latitude given to a rabbi to interpret the Torah in that way, to say some parts of the Torah should be disregarded, is that at odds with what you were saying?
Well, this is clearly not an Orthodox synagogue, first of all.
Yeah, okay.
First of all, you have a congregant who's not wearing a yarmulke and who's answering his phone. These are hard questions.
Do you think that it would be cool to try and get a rabbi to talk to us about some of this stuff?
Yeah, it actually would be. That's a very interesting idea.
In our pilot episode, there was a clip that we played of Hillary Clinton talking about how she gets scripture in the morning. She was responding to a question from a rabbi.
How do you cultivate the ego that we all know you must have, a person must have to be the leader of the free world, and also the humility to recognize that we know that you can't be expected to be wise about all the things that the president has to be responsible for?
Another absolutely wonderful question. Thank you, Rabbi.
And that rabbi commented on our Facebook page. Rabbi, will you introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm John Spirosavet. I'm a rabbi in Nashua, New Hampshire. I serve a community for the past 8 years called Beth Abraham. I've in the past been a high school educator in Jewish settings, working a lot with teenagers on issues of philanthropy and social justice.
Well, that's great, because Josh and I are basically teenagers.
That will be the level of discourse.
Excellent.
That is true. And Rabbi, approximate Jewish population of New Hampshire? Do you want to just call them out by name, or?
We're told that there are about 10,000 Jewish people in the whole state of New Hampshire.
Okay, 1,000 minions ain't bad.
Yeah.
And will you tell the story of how you connected with us?
Yes. And it gives me a chance to give a little shout out to my sister, Ellen, who lives in Zurich and who heard the podcast from the beginning. She's been a West Wing fan even longer than I have. And when she listened to the first one, she sent me it and also mentioned that the she pointed to the little audio bit that you played of Hillary Clinton. It was part of your reflection about the role of faith and politics.
And then you left a comment for us on our Facebook page, which is how we connected here.
Yes.
For the sake of the righteous Gentiles among our listeners and the less informed Jews, can you give us first some definitions, just maybe a simple definition of Torah and Talmud and Midrash, so that we can, from there, move on together.
Sure. I would say that that Torah means a couple of things. It means literally the five books of Moses, the first five books of the Bible. Sometimes we use the word Torah to be the Jewish word for Judaism generally, all the teachings of Judaism. The Talmud is a compendium of discussions about the laws that often goes in all kinds of different directions, which is anywhere, it collects teachings that are 2,000 to 1,500 years old, so certainly several hundred years after the Bible was written down. And Midrash refers to all the kind of interpretations and processes of interpretations that jump off from the Bible in all kinds of different directions.
Fantastic.
Josh and I have in the past on this podcast talked about the idea of interpretation and even specifically Talmudic interpretation. There's a line from the rabbi where he says that there are certain rules that are dictated, but by any modern standard, they're just plain wrong. And I was struck by the amount of latitude that a rabbi could really even articulate that.
Yes, and in fact, it wasn't even a modern sensibility, but that 2,000 years ago, the rabbis in the Talmud looked at the many death sentences that are pronounced in the Torah for maybe more than 30 different offenses and decided that it couldn't be done. For instance, the rabbi made reference to the rebellious son who, according to the Torah in Deuteronomy, can be taken out to the city gates and everybody in town stones this child to death. And they start asking questions like, well, when it says a son, you know, how old would that be? And obviously it can't be too young because they wouldn't know better. And if it's too old, it's not a child, but an adult. And eventually one rabbi says, this character of the rebellious son doesn't even exist. It's just here for us to talk about. They wouldn't go and write verses out of the Torah, but they would understand that there's a bigger picture that God has been teaching us in the meantime that we've been understanding that would actually prevent us from carrying these things out ourselves.
Somewhere in the Talmud, there's a discussion that a Sanhedrin that would put one person to death in 7 years would be considered like a hanging court. And then another rabbi says, no, one in 70 is even that is a murderous Sanhedrin. They really did try to create a situation where it really was capital punishment was unenforceable.
One part of the Talmud that's specifically about capital punishment and the teaching is that a person who saves a life, it's as if they've saved the entire world. And if a person takes a life, it's as if they've destroyed a whole world. And that's actually part of a warning, which in the Talmud is given to a witness at a capital crime. So the criminal who you suspect of murder, whose life you might think is the most worthless and the one that's easiest to take, that's the place in the Talmud where Judaism teaches that human life is so valuable and you should tremble at the thought that you would mistakenly or for the wrong purpose destroy a human life.
For you, Rabbi, when you're teaching, how do you reconcile passages you might find personally, morally wrong? How do you teach the text while also being true to your own moral compass?
Well, I think the idea is that because the Bible particularly is so old, and it may be the product of the best wisdom of its own time, but clearly it was the beginning of a discussion and not the end of it. And almost any discussion that we might have in conservative Judaism, it was about whether women should be equal to men in certain roles. And then more lately, it's been about LGBT. And it could be about this too. We have this feeling that we've been studying the conversations that have happened before, and they might have the seeds of a different vision. And we have to use that to correct our modern vision too, to make sure we're not just chasing a fad which might go away. And so it's kind of a process where we converse with our own history, and that sort of corrects us, hopefully, from being just selfish and imposing our own views. But it obviously clearly, you know, may hold us back sometimes from reaching a more inclusive vision as fast as someone who's not also wrestling with what's being carried along in an older text that also carries a more difficult moral message.
So far we've discussed the rabbinic take on capital punishment of the Talmudic era. What you've told us so far, does that explain the modern Jewish take on capital punishment? And is there a single, or does it change by denomination?
There is a pretty universal affirmation in modern Judaism of wanting to repeal capital punishment where it exists. And most of the modern Jewish movements have taken positions in favor of outright repeal or moratoriums on capital punishment. And the other thing is that in the state of Israel, which is a kind of modern lab for Jewish values. There's basically no capital punishment. And the most famous example of someone who was executed was Adolf Eichmann, who was a Nazi war criminal. So it's on the books for a couple of things, but certainly people who are terrorists who have committed, you know, terribly grisly murders, they go to prison. And while there is a concept of capital punishment in Israel, it is certainly in the judicial process almost completely absent.
In an earlier episode, we got into a discussion of acting approaches and the creation of backstory by an actor. William Duffy, who played Larry, who said, you know, he made up a whole backstory and he went to law school and where he went to school and stuff like that. And I contended that I took a Jewish approach, which is very textual, and hence I have an aversion to the creation of backstory. You and a couple others on our website took issue. I think the way you articulated it was that Jews generally really aren't textualists, and that the great wealth of Midrashic stories are, in fact, backstory. Is that correct?
Yes. And I was surprised, Josh, if I might go so far as to say that you expressed the position that you did, because I think it ties into what Rishi asked me before about how we deal with things that are written in the Bible, but seem so sometimes out of sync with things we understand today. And I think the trick is that we are textualists and that we look so carefully at the text that we think that there might be hints of backstory in it. One classic example is the character of Abraham, who, according to the Torah, sort of out of nowhere, God picks him and calls him to leave where he is and to go to this new unknown promised land. The text itself says that he should leave not only his homeland, but his father's house.
Terah.
Yes, very good. So the Midrash builds a kind of backstory that says that Abraham was for a while in the process of trying to figure out how to disengage with his father. And so the Midrash has a kind of backstory in which Abraham is a young man or even a boy and goes and sort of builds the figure of Abraham as someone who is already a kind of searcher, so that when God called him, he was already walking a little bit, and this kind of caught him along the way. So sometimes modern people will create even more backstory, but usually we're very respectful textually to the textual backstories that have been written down some centuries ago.
So here's where I'll push back slightly and then admit I'm wrong. That's my plan. I, of course, am not ignorant of these stories of Abraham and Terach and the many, many more. Here's where I question whether they are indeed backstory. My understanding of these kind of tales of the rabbis, I thought they were spun in part to reach people, to make the text more accessible. But did the rabbis posit these stories for us to take them as literally having happened? That's my question, I guess, ultimately.
Right. And it's not sort of literally that it should be a backstory, but I think it's exactly to your point with Ed and Larry about exploring motivations. That each of these kind of midrashic backstories gives us another layer, both as to why that figure, you know, Abraham or Moses, was or believed or acted the way that he did. But really, we to some degree might read in and relate to some of these backstories that are suggested to find where it touches us, where our point of experiencing the same conflict is. And then we use that as motivation to live out the example, let's say, of Abraham in our own life.
I think, and maybe this is just absolute linguistic hair splitting, and what's more Jewish than that? But my actor's job is, I think, absolutely diving in and trying to divine motivation and trying to figure out why the text says this at this point and why this happens and why my character reacts this way. But it's the literal creation of backstory. It's William Duffy deciding Larry went to Loyola Marymount when the writer still might write. We might find out 2 episodes later, no, he didn't. In other words, the specific literal acceptance of backstory or creation of such, to me, goes against the grain. So I still think I have a Jewish approach. It's not that it's all about interpreting the actual text. I mean, there are times even when, as a character, whatever, Will Bailey's sad, and I might think about a time that Josh is sad. That's not Will's backstory. That's motivation that enhances the character and the performance.
And this is why Midrash is great, is that it might often give you 2 or 3 backstories that don't necessarily mesh with each other. And they really are more like a vivid depiction of what a motivation would be like. And yes, they're not meant to be literal. And if you can use them in the way that you describe, I would have to agree with you.
I convinced the rabbi.
We found common ground. You know, I've been fascinated to how Aaron Sorkin, who I understand is Jewish, but is not religious and didn't have much of a religious upbringing. I think the whole thing is amazing to me that he is, how much credit he gives to the complexity of religion and how much depth he gives. And I'm kind of curious if you know, Josh, why, sort of where he comes to this. Why did he even decide to make the president a Democrat who's a Catholic? And do you know anything about what went into that?
I do believe that was input from Martin Sheen, am I right?
That's right.
Rishi?
Martin Sheen himself is a Catholic, and he requested that the character be a Catholic as well.
I'm not against requesting backstory. That's fine. Absolutely. Great stuff. Way to go, Martin. Yeah, so I think that was important. I think Bartlett's faith was an element that Martin Sheen brought to Aaron, and Aaron chose to incorporate.
And as you know, so often liberals are portrayed as non-religious or anti-religious, and it's not only a label, I think, that President Bartlett has, but it really, in so many places, is shown with great sensitivity to what it means to be a religious modern person. And I think this was a really great demonstration of that, even though it didn't come out in any package at the end. I don't know if this counts as a flental, but they
you just made my day that you even said that word.
But the prayer which we hear repeated, the Hebrew prayer during the fade out at the very end, has a line in it, which I think is heard in the chant there, which means, guide us with your good counsel. It was a nice way to pick up some of the message from maybe that scene and also from the episode.
Wow, beautifully put.
Thank you. This is an unbelievable honor, and I'm so excited.
Great. Thanks so much, Rabbi. Thanks for speaking to us. And now we're going to take a quick break. And now back to the show.
I was a little bit disappointed that, is it Father Thomas Kavanaugh?
Yes.
That he wasn't played by Tom Kavanaugh. Don't get me wrong, Carl Malden is great, but I just thought it would have been a nice little moment. He was good in Ed, and he would have been fine as Father Kavanaugh.
I don't know how well he comes off as sagacious.
Ah, yeah, he may have been lacking in the sagacious.
Sagacity.
Sagacity.
When the president asks Charlie about his feelings if they ever caught the guy who killed his mom.
What happened to the guy who shot your mother?
They haven't found him yet, sir.
If they did, would you want to see him executed? Killing a police officer is a capital crime. I figured you must have thought about it.
Yes, sir.
And?
I wouldn't want to see him executed, Mr. President. I'd want to do it myself.
I thought it was a very also great little piece of acting from Dulay. It's a very real moment and an elegant way. I assume you'll agree with me that the entirety of the episode falls heavily in the anti-capital punishment side of things. And the pro-capital punishment side really isn't even argued by anyone, except for this little elegant moment where, while not an argument, you at least understand the emotion behind it.
That is extremely well said. Even if you ultimately know which way they're going to fall on the argument, I love when they present both sides and in a compelling way. I think the fact that we don't hear so much from the anti-death penalty side is really resolved by the fact that in the end, the president doesn't act and Simon Cruz is executed. Even if they're essentially creating a polemic against the death penalty, and the plot of the episode, it's not like he races in at the last minute and says, save this guy. You know, it has this incredibly tragic timbre to it because all these arguments are being made and they're all convincing and they're all well articulated. And you can tell the president believes in them at some level. And yet in the end, he still doesn't act.
And then immediately after acting through inaction and allowing the execution to happen and getting the piece of information that in fact it has happened from CJ, he then gives his confession.
Yeah.
So immediately he considers himself to have sinned through inaction.
Yes.
It's actually very heavy. That's a heavy moment. So let me ask you, what is your take? Why didn't he stay the execution?
I think he frames it in the conversation that he has with Joey Lucas.
I've got a Harris poll says 71% of the American people support capital punishment.
That's a political problem.
I'm a politician.
Yes, sir.
I think this is now the most dire version of his political cowardice, his unwillingness to embrace his own ideals because of the politics of it, because of his own sense of his popularity with the American public, his sense of reelectability, any of those things informing him, all the stuff that Toby is there to kind of push back on. But here it's not just Toby. He is surrounded by this chorus of voices telling him, these are all the reasons why you should not do it, that you should follow your moral compass. And yet he still doesn't because of politics.
Including Leo saying,
if that's the only thing stopping you, then I'll say this for the first time in your presidency. Let that be the next guy's problem.
Also interesting, I find, after that conversation with Joey, even though he says to her, as if she's just being naive, I'm a politician, like this is what we do, he sends Josh after her to suggest that she become a politician. In other words, so he sees in her almost a kindred spirit in that she would be the type of politician who's going to wrestle with her conscience and doing the right thing. And even as, I guess, even in his own estimation, on a certain level, does the wrong thing, something on the level of sin, he sees value in her as potentially entering the political arena.
He sees her as the opposite of what O'Dwyer is. O'Dwyer is a stuffed shirt, and she's the real deal. She's grappling with the issues. She has an opinion. She has a point of view, and she can articulate them passionately and put both reason and morals into her decisions, which is really what I feel like you can ask for one person in office to do.
But this is even in, as you're pointing out, an episode in which he makes the ultimate move against his own inner voice.
Yeah, I would say this is a failure because even very smart people with great intentions make mistakes. But I love that. And I love that it's acknowledged right away in that confession scene. Since we're talking about the confession a little bit, can we talk about something we talked about recently, which is the formality of titles? Father Kavanaugh asks the president, how should I address you?
To be honest, I prefer Mr. President.
That's fine.
You understand why, right?
Do I need to know why?
It's not ego.
I didn't think it was.
There's certain decisions I have to make while I'm in this room. Do I send troops into harm's way? Which fatal disease gets the most research money?
Sure.
It's helpful in those situations. Not to think of yourself as the man, but as the office.
And I think that's all fine. But then it is interesting that he keeps calling him Tom.
I noticed the same thing, not father.
It sets up this dynamic between the two of them. Even as we realize, as we come to learn later, that they know each other, because Father Kavanaugh says, you're just this kid who was in my parish. And I think that there is this little subtle undercurrent of arrogance or something.
No, I think there absolutely is ego there. There's a continuing thread in Bartlett's character. He's got a healthy ego, no question.
But then there's this beautiful reversal at the very end in the confession. Father Kavanaugh says,
would you like me to hear your confession?
Yes, please. Bless me, Father, for I have sinned.
Oh, here's an interesting thing that I liked. It makes no sense, but I really like it.
He sent you a priest, a rabbi, and a Quaker, Mr. President, not to mention his son, Jesus Christ. What do you want from him?
And I was like, how does he know all that?
Oh, that is, yeah.
He just showed up. But how does he know that there was a rabbi and that Joey Lucas is a Quaker? And yeah, that she was in the thing, like, that's...
Yeah, I had the same thought, too. I thought, oh, so you've watched the episode up until this point.
Exactly.
Yeah. No, you're right. That's one of those moments you go, no, just, it works. It works. Just let it go. And also, Aaron and Tommy discussed this episode on the ATX panel in Austin. I'm guessing most of our listeners have listened to that podcast already, but there's some great little trivia bits. For instance, apparently Carl Malden used the Bible that he had used as Father Barry in On the Waterfront for this scene, which is just a great piece of information. I mean, I certainly noticed in the rewatching, but one of the things Aaron pointed out was their decision, or maybe Tommy's decision, that little reflection of
Simon Cruz and his mother.
Which was a great, I thought, subtle, very brief little glimpse into the specifics of it. You know, CJ, even as soon as she said she feels nothing, doesn't care, she's then moved by the fact that his mother has a name and that she, CJ, knows the name. And of course, when we see Cruz and we see his mother, now they have faces for us. Mm-hmm. And it's just a very, that was a great little stylistic choice. It didn't hit you over the head. Did you like it?
I feel fine about it. I think just because it was such a different stylistic move from the show, I'm not sure how to feel about it, but I don't.
I think what you're saying is no, you did not like it, and that's okay.
I didn't dislike it though. I understood what was happening. You know, I felt like that was the episode's version of the singer in the temple. You need a little bit of showmanship sometimes to like drive the point home. And I am okay with that.
I would say, first of all, I think this is what it sounds like when Rishi doesn't like something on the West Wing. I'm also going to say, it's funny that you point that out, because the cantor at the synagogue has been apparently set up by the rabbi to be singing this prayer, the beautiful prayer called the Hashkivenu, which is a prayer for peace. It's a little bit like that's the rabbi's plaintive oboe. It is. It's doing that little extra getting you there, which, as I've mentioned many times, sometimes works for me and sometimes doesn't. So you felt the same way about the little shot of
a little bit, yeah.
And his mother.
But specifically, the cantor I thought was incredible. And I love that they bring her back for the end of the episode.
For the closing flentil.
Exactly.
To me, it was almost too on the nose to have a flentil that is that Jewish. It was beautiful. I loved it.
There's one thing that I thought about. It's little, but I liked it. The fact that CJ doesn't want to know the mother's name, and the mother's name is Sophia, and Sophia means wisdom.
Ooh.
And I like that, and I might be reading too much into it, but if you have to pick a name, and one of the characters wishes they didn't know the name, Sophia is a great choice.
Good catch, Rishi. Yeah, I don't think Aaron takes naming lightly.
I love that the punchline to the story, to the parable or the joke, whatever it is, that God says,
I sent you a radio report, a helicopter, and a guy in a rowboat. What the hell are you doing here?
That like you've got a priest telling a story from the voice of God. God's line is, what the hell are you doing here?
That's funny. I didn't even pick up on that. That's good.
Can we talk about, for a second, a little bit more about the casting? Carl Malden and Marley Matlin, heavy hitters.
Yeah, and they're both great. And it leaves me wanting more Joey Lucas as soon as possible. She has a great, abrasive, romantic energy with Brad. I mean, there's clearly something there, but they're also really sort of butting heads in a way that I like. There's a good sort of romantic friction between them.
Yeah, there's one part I love when she's leaving.
It was nice meeting you.
Nice to meet you.
That was me saying that.
You didn't have a good time meeting me? You know what? I actually know that sign. Don't know that one, but
I can probably guess.
And I was trying to figure out what it was, and my sign language, I only know really like finger spelling, and she does it too fast for me to, and her back is to me, so I can, but I know it started with a B, and I think it goes B-I, and then it looked like it ended with like either M or E or both, and so I'm pretty sure she signed Bite Me.
Oh, nice. Nice. Can we get confirmation on that?
Yeah, if someone can confirm that, that would be great. But I'm pretty sure she says, Bite Me, which would be also very much in keeping with Aaron Sorkin's dialogue, even when it's not spoken. Somebody would say, Bite Me, for sure.
Yeah, that's very Aaron, you're right. I wonder how they came to cast her.
Yeah, I wonder if, I mean, you have to write that character as deaf for all those jokes to work, right? Or did he write it for her specifically?
Yeah, I'm guessing you wrote it for her specifically, and I think I will email him, and then maybe we can drop it in later.
Late breaking news here. Josh did email Aaron, and we got a response back.
I posed the following to Aaron. I wrote, hey, quick question. We are recording our podcast about Take This Sabbath Day, and we were wondering how you came to cast Marley Matlin. Did you reach out to her and then write Joey Lucas as deaf because she came on board, or did you conceive the role to be played by a deaf actress? Can you give me a little on that I can then read on the podcast? Very graciously, Aaron responded with lightning speed, and he wrote, Actually, it was because of you. After the Dear Louise episode of Sports Night, in which Jeremy is writing a letter to his sister who's hearing impaired, Marley asked if she could meet with me. She'd seen the show the night before and wanted to persuade me to write the sister into a future episode so she could play the part. Marley swept me off my feet in the meeting. She's abundantly charming, brainy, and funny, and her signing is like watching a world-class ballerina. I was never able to come up with an idea for a Sports Night story for Jeremy's sister, but a year later, I asked her if she wanted to play a campaign manager whose candidate is being treated badly by the DNC. The character's deafness would only be incidental to the story. Marley hit it out of the park, and so I always looked for opportunities to have her on the show.
So cool.
Interesting.
That's an even better origin story than I could have ever hoped for.
Another great little moment that I loved. The entire Josh Lyman is hungover, possibly still drunk, complete mess, smells bad, has to change into Sam's foul weather gear. I like the entire thing. Totally makes me laugh. And there is a fantastic moment when Donna brings him coffee, which apparently is cold, and he spit takes it just onto himself. It's a very, very well executed spit take. Hat tip to Brad Whitford.
Drink this.
Coffee.
It's strong drink at all. From yesterday, so it might not be hot anymore.
It's a different kind of spit take. It's not the projectile spit take. It's the dribble spit take.
That's true. It is, I think, it's a sister spit take to what I was asked to do on Sports Night. There's an episode
with the eggnog. Where
Jeremy cannot drink eggnog, and it's not a in your face spit take. It's a this just has to get out of my mouth. I'm just gonna let it fall. Let gravity do its thing.
It's much funnier. And so baffling, like when he first does it, you know, he takes a sip and then it just falls out of his mouth and you're like, is he missing some faculty? Yeah. And then Donna reveals, yeah, by the way, it's cold. On the complete opposite side of the spit take, you know, there've been a few lines like we could all be better teachers and we talk about enemies more than we used to that haven't always landed for me with the kind of gravity that I think they're supposed to.
I know where you're going.
But there is a line in this episode that I love, that I think is supposed to be doing the same thing. And for me,
Sam Seaborn line, yes?
Yes.
Leo, there are times when we are absolutely nowhere.
I think about that line in my life, my own life, a lot. That's a phrase that unfortunately like rings in my head when I watch the news so often. I love that one. And
it's a great line. Yeah, I agree. I liked it a lot. And it's funny, I did think of the other two lines that we had specifically discussed when I heard it. And actually, this episode is a nice sort of further teasing out of Sam's character. I feel like in a way he was developed more slowly, maybe because I feel like the Laurie storyline was whatever it was, but it wasn't the most revealing of his character as we would later come to know him.
Right. It's almost like a more of a leading man storyline. And
right.
And that's not necessarily the best deployment, it turns out, of Sam Seaborn.
Yeah, I agree. We're getting more of the character guy.
Yeah, the guy who is, I love that there are other indications besides the thing about Blackman, the thing that when he's talking to Toby, and Toby's getting mad at him for having revealed this personal information about his temple.
Toby, that never
should have been. How did the public defender know I was at that temple?
I'm saying this guy didn't have the world's greatest legal counsel.
How did he know where I was going to be?
I told him.
You told him?
Yeah.
Sam, what are you doing, giving out that kind of information?
I know. I don't know. Right at that moment, it seemed like what I should do.
He's not going to commute the sentence, Sam.
We don't know what the president's going to do.
It seemed like what you should do.
Yeah.
I think Toby's been presented as this guy who is, it may be a little dogmatic even about certain things. And it's nice to have Sam have his own version of that.
Yeah. I liked also that his time off was going to be spent on a boat, as if he is indeed of the Seaborn.
Ha ha!
Like, huh, what's his little hobby?
Very nice.
He likes to sail.
What's Josh's hobby? He likes to tell lies to men.
There you go, man.
And that's it for our episode.
Another one in the can.
Thanks so much for joining us, and we hope you'll join us next time.
In the meantime, if you want to reach out to us on Twitter and follow us, which is really what you ought to do, I'm at Josh Molina. Rishi is at Rishi Hirway. Should we be spelling that?
I figure if they've taken enough time to listen to this episode, they've taken enough time to figure out how to spell Rishi Hirway.
Fair enough.
And I have to say, I get a certain kind of thrill from the fact that so many people on our Facebook page and in our comments on our website spell my name correctly. I don't think I've ever seen such a vast number of strangers getting my name right.
And let me just piggyback on that and say, considering how long I've been acting, it's shocking to me how many people on our Facebook page spell my last name incorrectly.
Yeah.
What else? Our show also has a Twitter feed. It's at West Wing Weekly.
You can also leave a comment for us or for other West Wing Weekly listeners on our website, thewestwingweekly.com, or on our Facebook page, facebook.com/thewestwingweekly. We're working on some exciting things, but in order to get them lined up, we have to take next week off, but we'll be back the week after that. Okay?
Okay.
What's next? If you're looking for another podcast to listen to, check out Normal Gossip from Radiotopia. They're coming back for their sixth season. If you don't already know the show, they were named one of the best podcasts of the year by Time Magazine and Vulture, and their new season starts April 17th. Normal Gossip is really fun. It's a show about petty and ridiculous and strange stories and the way that we share those stories. The stories that they tell in the podcast are sent in by listeners, and then they're anonymized and then retold to a guest, and then they have to weigh in on the decisions that the people in the story are making. It's very funny and very beloved. So if you aren't already listening, check out the new season, which starts April 17th. You can listen to Normal Gossip wherever you get your podcasts.
Radiotopia.